So time complexity in computer science is the way that we measure how much resources our computer is using relative to the size of some data input that we feed it. And we typically denote time complexity with big O notation. And the way we do that, you can say O of 1 means that given data input quantity of any size, it'll always be able to process that data in the same amount of time, no matter how big the data input is. It'll always take the same amount of time to process it. You can also have O of n, known as linear time, and in that case, the computer will process the data using its computational resources at relative to the size of the list. So the smaller the list of data you feed it, the quicker the computer will be able to process it. Other ones you can use that are come up, there's logarithmic time. An example of a logarithmic time process was in lecture when David had everybody stand up and raise their hand. And that's the way, and then you would do the counting to count the number of people in the class. And you found out that it took log to the base 2 of n number of steps to figure out how many people were in the class. And so that was a process that would have run if we did it in a computer in logarithmic time. I spelled that wrong. And there are also, you have superlinear time, which is n times log n, so it's just sort of a combination of these two. You have polynomial time, which is n squared, n to some constant. So again, the size of the list gets bigger, the amount of time it takes to process it using your computational resources gets progressively, exponentially bigger. There's exponential time, which is even worse, and factorial time, which is some of the worst processes that you can have. So what we're going to do now is we're going to practice seeing some processes, and we're going to look at their time complexity and see if we can figure out why these processes take as long as they do, see if we can start to understand the process of time complexity a little better. So we're going to pretend that we have some array. And for the sake of simplicity, we'll just make it an array of integers. So we would declare this array as follows. You know, just give it a type, give it a name and a size. You declare that somewhere in your line of code. Create for you an array of size 6, where each block is an integer, which is what we have here. You just initialize it to those values. You can do it statically or however you'd like. And so what we're going to try and do is we want to check and see if some number is contained within this array. Say we want to see if the number 7 appears. So we're going to use a linear search algorithm. And so we're just going to step iteratively through the array and see if we can find the element. So what you can do is you can have some function called search, and we'll have it return a Boolean. As the arguments to this function, we're going to pass in some array. We'll even just pass in this one. Say this will only take arrays of size 6. And some value, the target, which is the element that we want to find in the array given. So what is one way that we can step through an array that we've learned about in this class so far? A for loop is a great way. So we know that the array, we need to declare some iteration variable. Canonically, we'll use I. And then we just want to step through the array. So we're going from for I equals 0, I is less than, not 5, I is less than 6, because this will give us every element from the index array 0 to array 5. And we just want to step through it. So if target is equal to array I, then we can do, since this is returning a bool, we just want to say, okay, yes, this element is in the array. So if the element appears in the array, we're going to have the function return true because we're returning a boolean. And if we've stepped through every element of the array and target is not in the array, then we're going to return false because we know that this isn't contained. So we all could have written that loop ideally by this point, but we didn't know how efficient the loop was. And now we have a way of checking that. We can look at the time complexity of this function, of the linear search algorithm, which is basically we just wrote in code here. This is basically all that you need to do to get to figure out the time complexity of the algorithm. Yeah?
Is the return false outside of the for loop?
The return false is outside of the for loop, yes. I forgot to put a brace. So if at any point it is there, we're just going to return true. Now, what do you think? Do you think that given the size of any array, no matter how big the array is, even though this function is only going to take arrays of size 6, is it always going to be able to do it in the same amount of time? What do you think? No, because if the array was one bigger, you know, if we had some array where we had an extra element at the beginning of it, then instead of possibly taking 6 steps to go through it, we're going to take 7. So we know it's not constant time. Is there anyone up there that you think it might be? A tip is that so it runs in linear time because given the size of an array, it could take anywhere from 0. You could find it on the first try. If we were looking for 8 in this array that's now size 7, so we'll get rid of it. If you're looking for 3 in this array, we would find it on the first try. But if we were looking for 1, it would take 6 steps. And if the array was bigger, you know, had more elements over here, and we were looking for 1, it would take even more steps. So we know it doesn't take not 1 or 3. It's variable, but it's variable in a linear fashion. Okay? So, yeah, in the best case, this runs in O of 1, which is if it can be found, if the element in question is the first element in the array. This is the best case. In the worst case, it's going to take n steps, where n is the size of the array that you need to search through. And so in the average case, it's going to be the average of these two. And so given the element randomly appearing somewhere in the array, if it appears in the array, on average, it will run an O of n plus 1 over 2, which is not really anything we've defined here. It just happens to be what the time complexity of this algorithm is. So there are other algorithms that we can use that run in different time. Another one is binary search. An important note on binary search algorithms, unlike linear search algorithms, binary search algorithms only work when the array is sorted. So when the elements are in, for our purposes, we're going to use ascending order, but they could also be in descending order. So we're just going to give a quick little example of what the binary search algorithm is. So you have some function, you're writing it in a function, and you set first equal to 0, because we're going to have the index of the array be 0 as the first element. And the last, some variable last, is the array size, which you will have to determine. And in C, as you know, there's no way to just write array.size like you could do in C++ or in Java. There are other methods that you can use to get an array size. But in C, you need to know it explicitly. You can't determine it unless you slap some terminating character on the end of the array. So if you know these two and you want to find some target, you just need some loop. So I'll explain, I'm going to write the algorithm out and then I'll explain why it works the way I'm writing it out. So, and this isn't going to be in, this is just sort of pseudocode. This is minus. And we're going to also assume that this is some Boolean function. Okay. So what this loop is basically saying, this is going to be our binary search algorithm. So given some array, as long as we haven't reached a point where the two are equal, which means that we've gone through the array because we're going to end up compressing the dimension we're looking for. As long as we haven't gone through the entire array, we're not at the same element. We're going to find the that we're in right now, the average, and we're going to look for some number. And so, if the number we're looking for, say we'll use this array as an example here. Remember, this array has to be sorted, so. And say our target value is 3. We want to find 3 is our target. So when we start out, this is first, and this is last. And middle is going to be the average of first and last. So we know this is index 0. This index is 6, so the average of that is 3. So that's middle. If target is less than array middle, so 3 we can see is less than 6. So what it's going to do is set last to be middle minus 1. So now we're changing last from here to here is where it's moving. And then neither of these is true. So it's just going to forget them, go back to the beginning of the while loop. It's going to check first still less than last. Yes, 0 is less than 2, which is where last is now set. Middle is the average of first and last again. So now middle moves 2. To the average of first and last. Target is not less than array middle, it's equal to it. So this isn't going to be true. It's not greater either, so this isn't going to be true. Which means that since we're still in the array, as in we haven't gone down to just one element left. And as we can see, 3 has been targeted by the binary search algorithm and has found it. So every time that you run this algorithm, what you're doing is the first time we ran it, we found that it was less than this value here, which meant that we knew it didn't appear anywhere in this part of the array. So we just cut out half of the array. That's why it's binary, is that we're halving the array. Cut it down by a factor of 2. So now we have a new array, and it's of size 3. And well, in this case, we happen to just find it. So, but in other cases, you could, you know, if this was a little bit longer, we could have said, oh, it's not here either, and cut the size again by 2. And so every time we're doing that, we're taking some logarithmic. Let me explain this a little better. So every time that we don't have what we're looking for, but we haven't reach the end of our calculations, we're getting rid of half the work we have to do. So it's compressing the amount of work we have to do logarithmically. Which means that if the array is of size 2, it's only going to take one pass through it. And if the array is of size 4, it's going to take at most 2 passes through it. Because, you know, if we have this, and we're looking for 2, it's going to say, okay, is the average of these, and it'll round. Okay, well, this is a bad example, too. No, because when you do the, because since first and last are integers, when you divide, you'll just get some truncated integer for middle. So if, you know, if last is 5, would be 2.5. So it's just going to say 2, which again gives us the answer we were looking for. I wish I prepared a better example for this, but, sorry? If we're trying to find 1 instead of this one? Okay, so if we're trying to find 1, it's going to... So, what would happen if you're trying to find 1? So, first would be 0, because you wouldn't have this guy anymore. This would be 0. This would be 3. So, while first is less than last... which it is, middle is the average of the two, so it'll find, it'll be 0 plus 3 divided by 2, which is 1, and we're trying to find, you want to find the element 1? So this is where middle is now here. Is target less than array middle? Yes. Cuts everything else out. Though I guess in that case, first is not necessarily less than last. So perhaps I wrote this algorithm a little hastily. A better algorithm of this, had I done a little better, would have checked when first equals last, is that the element? So I apologize for that. Thank you. That was a good question. What would I do instead? So while first is less than last, do this. And then check, if this doesn't work, you know, if you've failed this condition, then you know you're down to just one element left in the array. And so what you should do, and that element will be first by default, because of the way the algorithm works, to change first and last. And then just check if array first equals target. This algorithm doesn't catch it. I should have said... first is like less than or equal to. Might fix that. No, because I won't move anymore. No. Just, it would be good to put an extra check condition for when, because when first is equal to last, you just have one thing left. But the point of all of this binary search stuff was to demonstrate that this is going to cut through your array a lot faster than that is. And we know that in general, n is a much larger number than log. So the binary search algorithm is an example of an algorithm that works with time complexity log n. Sorry? Explain why it works with log n. Is log n. Because each time you make a pass through the array, you cut the amount of work you have to do by 2. Here, you take the amount of work you have to do and you just subtract by 1. So in the worst case, this will take n steps.
Mm-hmm. And then count one, add one to each other.
Right.
So he said the best situation you can get, for example, there are 129 students. Mm-hmm. The best step you can get is 8, right?
Right.
Because 2 to the power of 8 is greater than that.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder, for example, at each, the first stage, each of those are paired and then add one to each other. So it's that each adding is counted as 1, or the whole process is counted as 1.
It's the pass through. Well, it's because each adding is happening. The way that wouldn't be, it wouldn't work like that in an actual computer. It would be different. But the way the process was illustrated is that, you know, as everything's happening simultaneously, and it's.
I just wonder what the running time
These numbers aren't entirely perfect. This is like, it's very close. It's a general representation of how many resources. It's time complexity, how much time the things will. Yes, because
the total number adding is equal to each other, right?
Is it though? Because if you are adding 129 people together, and you're saying, you know, you have these people,
yeah.
You're still, so, you know, you have all these people. The first people add themselves together, and now you have two.
Yeah.
But then there's adding themselves, and then you have three, four. So you're going to have 128
yep.
additions.
Yep.
But the way we were doing it was, so you have all these people.
True.
And they're, okay, two.
Yep.
See what you're getting at.
So how many steps have you counted with this? It's like 64.
It's
65, whatever. 64, 65.
Yeah, so.
Last one is great, say. Okay, so we say 128 people, which yeah. makes it simpler,
right?
Right. Okay, so we say 128. And for the first method, we need to do 127 addings. For the second one, at the first stage, we're going to do 64 addings.
Right.
Second stage, 32. Third stage, 64.
So you're ending up with the same number.
Right.
Because then.
That's my question. So, because we also have to do 127 addings in total.
Is it the same?
So is that the same time?
If this was implemented as a computer, yes.
Okay.
Since we were. We were sort of glossing over and presuming that.
We were all like multiple CPUs.
Yeah, we were multiple CPUs. We're all independent. And we can all process these things simultaneously. We're sort of, you know, we have like parallelism in our system.
So you're saying, for example, that in this time complexity method, you know, kind of concept, saying the first method is going to take 127 units of time. The second one is going to
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
No problem. Sorry, I wasn't explaining that clearly. For those of you who didn't hear the question, it was about we did in class on Monday with the way we count people. Would there be a difference between taking each person and just having them say hi to the person next to them and add one number each time, which if we had 129 people, we'd take 128 iterations. It would be 128 steps to get everybody's sum. Or if we did the process that we did in class, it's still the same number of calculations, but we were presuming that we had parallelism in our system. So we could perform these actions simultaneously, and they had the same time cost to us. And that is the difference between why, in this case, it's 128 steps. And while this case is 128 steps too, if you have 120 people, we were running multiple processors, so we were able to sort of gloss over the time complexity issue. That answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So now we're going to move on from time complexity. It's just a matter of understanding, taking a look at the algorithms that you write and seeing whether or not, you know, you have best case scenarios. And, you know, sometimes the best case scenario is going to be n squared. It's going to be quadratic and unpretty, and that's fine. But frequently, we're able to improve our processes a little bit. So I'm going to erase the board, or these boards here. Log n, well, constant time is the fastest. Log n is the fastest you'll get in principle. I mean, obviously, it depends on what the constant. It's not necessarily O of 1. It's O of C, but 1 is typically used. Log n is a very good time complexity to attain in an algorithm. So right now I'm going to demonstrate a simple example of recursion, as I walk through this cloud of chalk, recursion versus iteration. Recursion is a very important topic in computer science. It's going to come up a lot when we talk about pointers and trees in the next few weeks, when you want to search through those. So we're going to jump away from time complexity just for a minute, and we're going to talk about recursion and the stack. So say we want to write a function called summation. We're going to pass in some parameter n. And what we want this function to do is to return to us, or return to main, or whatever function called it, the sum of all the numbers from 1 to n. So can somebody give me an example of a way we could do this that you already know? How would we write a way to figure out the sum of all the numbers from 1 to n? For loop. And what are our, what are we going to use? We're going to introduce some, okay, we're going to introduce some loop variable I. Okay. From 1 to n, yeah.
Okay. I equals 1. Yeah. And then I smaller or equal to n.
I is less than or equal to n.
Wait, should be small.
This is right, because you want to catch n too.
Yeah.
If it was less than n, you'd get the numbers from 1 to n minus 1.
Yeah, yeah. I plus plus.
Then, so we want to get the total. So we're probably going to need another.
So total plus.
So we're going to declare total. Yeah. And we'll say, since we're not summing anything, we'll start it at 0.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you're suggesting that we just do total.
Plus equal to
I. Plus equal to I. Okay. And then that's all we need to do, right? We're gonna return it. We're gonna presume that some function called it, and we'll use print it or do whatever it needs to do with it. Okay, so yeah, that's really all you need to do to summation. We're getting every number from 1 to n. Less than or equals 2 catches that. I plus plus means we increase by 1. Total plus equals. For those of you who have not been introduced yet, plus equals. If you say, you know, k plus equals I, is the same as saying k equals k plus I. And for those of you who know your operator precedence rules, you know that assignment works from right to left. So if k is equal to 3 and I is equal to 2, it's first going to assign this value k and this I to, again, k, but it's going to update it. So k plus equals I is the same as k equals k plus I. Those are equivalent. Where did my eraser go? Okay. So there's nothing wrong with this, the iterative procedure that we've done here. As you see, we had to introduce some new variable total. We didn't really need that, or it's just sort of it's extra code. It'd be nice if we could get rid of that. We also introduced I, a loop variable. We didn't need to use that either. We could have said, we could have left this blank, n, 0, n minus minus. There's a lot of ways we could have done this. This is totally fine, though. But there are other ways to do it. And one of those ways to do it is with recursion. Now, when you define a function recursively, what you need to do is have some, so a recursion algorithm in computer science has two parts. First of all, it has a recursive process, which means, and when we say recursive process, a function, something is typically defined as being recursive. It is defined in terms of itself. A function that is defined in terms of itself. Maybe kind of a weird concept. We're going to change this summation into recursion, and we'll see if we can get it a little clearer. And it has some base case or stopping case. And the base case is so, you know, if a function is defined in terms of itself, it's going to call itself. But we don't want it to call itself forever. We're going to be waiting a really long time for the answer that we want to get. So a base case is going to prevent us from running into some infinite condition we don't want. So let's think about a way, let's see if we can craft some recursive process to handle summation. So if we want the summation of all the numbers from 1 to 7, actually I'll make it simple, we'll say summation of all the numbers from 1 to 4, we know that that is equal to 4 plus 3 plus 2 plus 1, 0, if you're being, want to do that too. So, but we also know, you know, if this is the summation of 4, and what if we want to do the summation of 3? That is equal to 3 plus 2 plus 1 plus 0. If we do summation of 2, I'm going to keep abbreviating here. And so we see that this, you know, this appears as part of this. And then this guy here appears as part of this. So what we're doing is, you know, for summation of 4, it really boils down to 4 plus summation of 3. And for summation of 3, it's really 3 plus summation of 2. So what we're doing is we're breaking the problem down into smaller and smaller pieces until we know how to solve this certain small. We don't want to do all the work. We want another function to do all the work for us. And that function could be our function again, but with a different input. So we know for a base case, let's say if we're doing the sums of all the numbers from 1 to n, we know the sum of 1. I mean, it may be kind of weird to think of a sum of one number, but 1 is just equal to 1. So that could be our base case. We could say, I want to keep doing something until you give me an answer that I know very easily, 1. So the base case, we could say, if n is equal to 1, then we just know that that answer is 1. So we'll just return 1. Otherwise, though, this problem is a little too big for me to handle. So I'm going to try and break it down into smaller pieces and see if maybe the piece that I pass off is something that's easily solvable. So let's see if we can turn the iterative process that we wrote into a recursive process, noticing that for summation, summation of n is really n plus the summation of all the numbers from 1 to n minus 1. Like this is, when you get to recursion, it's all about noticing a certain property, if you want to use recursion, noticing patterns. And if you notice a pattern that repeats continuously, then that's probably the recursive process that you want to craft when you are writing a recursive algorithm. So let's take the same function again and see if we can define it recursively. So let's see. We know that the sum, if n is 1, we know that we just want to return what? You just want to return 1, because we know that answer. Otherwise, if it's not equal to 1, we need to return something else. Any guesses on what we want to return? Noticing that the sum of all the numbers from 1 to n is the same as n plus the sum of all the numbers from 1 to n minus 1. So you want to return summation of what? Of n minus 1 plus n. That's really all it is. And now we've defined the function sum in terms of itself. So, you know, if we're passing in 4, you know, we'll step through this actually in a second. We're going to work on the stack. We'll do this. I'll show you how the stack works on this. I know that recursion can be something kind of tricky to get your head around. So let's take a look at this. So we're passing in some argument n. And for the sake of this argument, we're presuming that n is a positive integer greater than or equal to 1. If n is 1, which is the simplest case that we can get, in the sum from 1 to n, we're just going to return 1 because we know that answer. If it's 2, I mean, yeah, inherently we know that the answer is 3, but you don't have, you know, some switch statement, switch case 1, return 1, case 2, return 3, you'd never stop writing code for the rest of your life. But if it's not 1, we know that we can make the problem a little easier. We're going to try and get to 1 because we know how to solve 1. But we also know that the sum of all the numbers from 1 to n is just n plus this smaller problem. So let's take a break for 2 minutes, and we will talk about the stack, and we'll demonstrate this process and how it looks in a computer. Okay? All right, so we're back. We're going to now demonstrate, using the algorithm over here that we wrote for a recursive algorithm, and we're going to show you how it looks in the stack on the computer. So we have some main function, using chalk that is easier to write. And somewhere in our main function, it's going to call this function sum, and we'll pass in 4. So we want to get the sum of all the numbers from 1 to 4, which we know to be 10, but let's just see how it looks. So as you know, there's a thing called the stack, which is sort of like the pecking order of function. And if a function is called from another function, the function that you're in is pushed down, and the function that is currently running is on the top of the stack. And if you keep adding functions, it gets pushed down, has to wait its turn for the above functions to finish, and then it will complete its job. And in recursion, the stack is enormously useful, and we'll see. So I'm going to build the stack this way because we're going to be putting stuff on it. So we're going to start our stack in main. And then main is going to call sum of 4. So right now, sum of 4 is running. Main is just waiting its turn for that function to finish. Sum of 4 looks at the algorithm we asked, and it says, am I equal to 1? Is my argument equal to 1? The answer is no. So it knows that instead it's going to have to return n plus the sum of all the numbers, four, plus the sum of all the numbers from 1 to 3. But when it says this, it's calling the function sum again. So now sum of 4 has to wait until sum of 3 has an answer that it can use. Sum of 3 says, am I equal to 1? No. But I know that I'm 3 plus the sum of something smaller, and maybe that knows what it's doing. Again, we've called another function. So now we're starting to build our stack a little bit. All these guys are waiting for sum of 2 to do its job. Unfortunately, for sum of 2, it can't do its job because it is also not equal to 1. So sum of 1 is called. It's added to our stack. But now we finally hit a breakthrough. Sum of 1 says, am I equal to 1? Yes. And it knows that when it's equal to 1, it's going to return 0. Return 1, sorry. So it can say, all right, I'm done. I'm equal to 1. Now this moves off the stack. Sum of 2 is now on the top of the stack. We're just going to presume that I cross something out. Everything moves up. Sum of 2 says, okay, I'm actually equal to 2 plus 1. I have an answer here. But I don't need to do any. I don't need to wait for anybody else to give me my answer. So sum of 2 is 2 plus 1. So this is equal to 3. I'm done. 3 also knows it's 3. It knows it's 3 plus 3, and it's not saying, okay, I'm waiting for sum of 2. It has all the information it needs. See you later. 6. Sum of 3 is now gone. Sum of 4 is now at the top of the stack. It's going to do the same thing. It knows that it's equal to 10. And now finally, after all the, you know, we had this stack of all these functions that we kept pushing down, making them wait until we were able to solve a problem of a smaller scale. And main finally has the answer of 10. So in recursion, frequently, functions are just made to wait. They're made to wait for an answer smaller. And the stack just builds and builds and builds. But once it hits the base case, it it just, it's what's called popping out the stack. It just, I'm drawing this like upside down. I really should have a better example of it, but it's just going to knock out every function along the way, and it does it very quickly because there's no more waiting for another function to be called. There's no more waiting for them to answer to another function. It just says, okay, I have all the information that I need, and it just passes it up to the function above it, which has all the information it needs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, until you get to the function that called it in the first place. Generally, that will be main. It's the same thing when it's the same thing happens when you call any function, not just necessarily recursive. If you have main and you're running it and you call some function func, main is going to be on the stack again. So we'll start a new stack. And then when func is called, main gets pushed down the stack. Function is now doing something. Function could call something else, and et cetera, et cetera. Waiting for the return value, eventually you'll get it, and you can pop back up the stack and get back to main. OK, kind of a crash course on recursion. Does anybody want me to do a different example of recursion, or? Yeah?
I have a question. So I mean, we're doing recursion, for example, like you're adding numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is it going to consume a lot of memory?
It does consume a lot of memory. It's not always the most efficient. Sometimes it's more this. For the case of summation and for the case of if you're doing a factorial, for example, recursion, the cost of an extra variable or two is pretty negligible compared to the cost of running a function, running 100 copies of a function. There are other processes, however, where recursion is essential or makes your life considerably easier. When you're going through a tree, for example, which we'll learn about in a few weeks, doing that iteratively would take up enormous amounts of memory. But with recursion, it's just moving down. I'm not going to get into too much detail about trees right now. There are for the process I'm illustrating right now, recursion is a more resource-consuming way to handle the problem. But it's also a more elegant way to handle the problem, so style points. Good style points for using recursion. In this case, it's not more efficient. It's not necessarily more efficient. It's just a matter of reality. Like, I'm trying to think. Let me think of an example where it's more efficient. You know, the only examples I can come up with are trees, and I don't want to introduce trees right now. I feel like that would be counterproductive. The efficiency lies in the fact that your code is relatively compact. You really are only doing work in one case, which is the base case. Otherwise, you're making life easier for something else. I wish I had a better explanation for. It's a matter of simplifying problems to a scale that you really can understand. Which is why it's efficient. You don't have to, like with this, you have to be. I mean, it may seem like there's no difference between these two, and I mean, yeah, they net the same result. You have to be ready to. How do I phrase this well? You sort of have to be ready to handle a problem of any size, no matter what. Whereas this, you really only have to handle a problem of one size. Because this guy, if it doesn't know how to do it, it's just going to pass it off to somebody else. So you really only have to, like you see here, we're returning one. But here we're returning the work of somebody else. I mean, yeah, it's another copy of this. It's the same guy. With that, you know, you have to step through everything. With this, you're tackling the whole problem at once. And with this, you're tackling the whole problem a piece at a time. It's sort of like the best way to explain why this is more efficient. You just have to throw yourself at it if you're doing it iteratively, and you can step back and break it, like we did with the array, you know? If we wanted to go through each to find the element in the array, we're looking through each part of it. But search algorithms, we're taking the array, we're breaking it in half, we don't need this part, do it again, we don't need this part. We're making the problem smaller so we know how to solve it until we get to the case where there's only one element left, and that's what we're looking for. Say we're looking for 3. So does that answer your question a little better about why? Okay, excellent. All right, so we have about 30 minutes left. I would like to get into a couple of... I was going to talk about writing binary search recursively, but I can provide you with that later. I want to get into some sorting algorithms. Algorithms. Now we're going to jump back to... Is everybody okay? Is it okay if I erase this? Okay. Sorting algorithms, we're going to move back to time complexity again. We'll talk about that. And also, sorting algorithms are a lot of fun if you're into that kind of thing. So we'll get a chance to... You know, like I said earlier, when we were using linear search versus binary search was only going to work on an array that it did. And we noticed that it was significantly more efficient. Ran in log n time versus n time. But, we needed to have a sorted array. But you don't always have a sorted array, so now we're going to come up with a way to sort one. One of the most popular, if considerably inefficient, ways to do it, something called bubble sort. So I'll give you an array. Let's say we have an array. This one's actually in the lecture notes if anybody is reading those. And we will step through. So we have this array of integers of size 8. Okay. So this is the way we start with, and we want to sort it so that it is in ascending numerical order, 1 to 8. The bubble sort algorithm works such that you want to step through an array. We will have some integer number of swaps. Bubble sort works by swapping values. We'll see how it does it in a second. And just some loop. So we want to, for the size of the array, if array I is greater than array I plus 1, we want to swap them. And if not, we just want to leave it the same. And if we swap them, we want to increase number of swaps. And we want to do this while the array is unsorted. And we know the array is unsorted if swaps have been made. If we go through the array and we never swap anything, then we're done. It's sorted. So we want to keep doing this while in the last pass we had to make a swap. Okay, so now let's take a look at this in action. So for the size of the, so we're going to just step through this array, and we're going to take a look at it each step of the way. First case, 4 greater than 2. Is 4 greater than 2? Yes. So we want to swap them, and let's put it temporarily here. So now we were here, and now we're going to move here, and now this element is 4. So we know that 2 goes here. 2 has been moved to the far left. Is 4 greater than 6? No. Also, we made a swap, so number of swaps is now 1. We swapped 2 and 4. So we said, is 4 greater than 6? No, so 4 stays there. Is 6 greater than 8? No. 8 greater than 1? Yes, so we want to switch them. 8 is now here, and 1 is here. And now we've made 2 swaps. Is 8 greater than 3? Yes. So 3 now is here, 8 has moved here. 8 greater than 7? Yes, etc. And the entire process, it looks like this. And we have made 4 swaps, I think. So the reason this is called bubble sort is because if you notice, 8, the biggest value, was bubbled across the array as the final spot. But now we have this array 24613758, not sorted. We know that because the number of swaps it took. Four is the number of swaps. I think it actually might be five, though. I might have made a mistake. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's 5 swaps. So we have this array here. So this array is still not sorted. We know that because we had to make swaps. We actually don't know that it's not sorted. It could be sorted. Now, after making all the swaps, we could have the array sorted. But we need to make a final check just in case. So we run the bubble sort algorithm again. I'm not going to go through it each time, but now we get this. And now you can see that 7, that looks like a 9, 7, which was the second smallest element in the array, has now swapped again. And now 7 has bubbled its way to the end. And if you continue this process, you'll eventually discover that every number will bubble itself over. This array happens to take 4 passes. And then it will end up as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, so now let's take a look at this in time complexity. We have an array of size n. So for each time we go through it, we have to look at each element. So we make n comparisons. We actually make n minus 1 comparisons. We have n amount of resources expended. But if we had the array, 8, 1, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, we would eventually have to swap everything. And we'd have to make n passes of this algorithm. So we have n passes of the algorithm on an array of size n, which means that bubble sort, in the worst case scenario, is going to run an n squared time. N passes of the algorithm through an array of size n, at worst. You could have it so that it's already sorted. Constant time. Linear time, sorry. You still have to check and go through this, because we want to keep doing this while number of swaps is not equal to 0. So if you get through this algorithm once and make a single swap, you're done. But you still ran it in linear time. As I said, bubble sort is a cool little algorithm. It's a great way to learn how to sort, but it's extremely inefficient. Average cases does run in about n squared time. So use it while you're learning how to sort. There's a few more algorithms that we'll talk about. Let's see here. Another one, selection sort. Which is slightly better. Not really, though. Let's take the same array. Four, two, six, eight, one. Same array we started with. What selection sort algorithm does is, start at I equals 0. So we're going to start here. You want to pass the entire array find the smallest element and swap wherever that element is with array 0, or array I. And then just increase I. So in this case, select and sort. It's going to go through this. Going to discover that 1 is the smallest element, but it's still going to keep going to see if there could be a 0, there could be a negative number. And then everything else is going to stay the same, except for 1 and 4 will be swapped. Same thing happens again. 2 is, so now we know this element is definitely the smallest element in the array. 2 is now we're going to be where I is 1. And it's going to look and see. Finds the small. So that was kind of an inefficient, wasted pass. We one, but we didn't know that. So again, this is going to take, this worst case is going to take n passes on an array of size. So again, I'm going to run n squared time. I looked it up. There's a slight advantage to selection sort of a bubble sort. If you look up merge sort, an even more efficient algorithm that employs recursion. And it runs in superlinear time, which I didn't describe, but is n log n. So it's significantly better. And there's a quick sort, which is one of the fastest sorting algorithms known. It can sort an array of about 100,000 elements in about 0.3 seconds, which ranges from n log n to n squared, depending on how badly the array is to start with. Okay, so merge sort is sort of a complicated algorithm. So I have a drawing that I've made because I'm an artist. And we'll see if you see how quickly this breaks down. So let's take an array of size, what did I give? 7. I found this, but I drew it out on my own. So we want to sort this array. We could use bubble sort. It would take n squared passes. We could use selection sort. It would take n squared passes. What merge sort does is it creates a partition. It just breaks the array at a certain point, and it's going to recursively sort each of your subarrays. So this just this picks a partition somewhere in the middle, and it goes and it just breaks it down into 2 subarrays. This is why it's like reminiscent of like a binary type algorithm, which is why it runs at a good pace. So it sort of breaks these down. I'm not going to sort anything yet, just break them. And then, you know, this guy is still a little too complicated. I don't know how to sort an array of size 4. So I'll break it down, see if I can make it a little better. So it breaks it down into smaller pieces. Yeah, the code to do this is more complicated. I might have a pseudocode representation of it. No, not if you don't want to. It's efficient, fast sorting, but you can use other sorting algorithms if you'd rather not. And we also don't know how to, you know, we don't know how to sort arrays of size 2 either. So, but we know how to sort arrays of size 1. So now what it breaks it down to is basically a subarray. This is the way to like imagine it in your head. This is the process that you would go through. You down to subarrays of size 1 until you have a one-dimensional array for everything. So let's switch these guys. I don't know if I can use that. So now that you have these guys are sort of like linked together, like they're next to each other in memory. So it knows how to sort these 2 back into another 2-dimensional array. It knows that that's the case, because you can know how to compare one to another. Same thing here. And here. Obviously, this guy. But it hasn't forgotten this either. We'll jump down a board. And it knows how to sort this. It's just going to, now it's going to look, OK. It's going to keep track of its position in both arrays. So 3 is less than. Now we're here and here in this one. 27 is less than 43. Now it's over here. 38 is less than 43. Okay, I'm done with this one. So now I just take whatever's here, all the rest of it is tacked on the end. Same thing here. Starts here and here. Switches lower. 9 moves it over. Which is lower, 10, moves it over, Nothing here, so you know that from this array, whatever's left is tacked on the end. Sure. So when you're at this point, it's going to start at the first element of this subarray and the first element of this subarray. And it's going to say, which of these two is lower? It's going to find out which one is lower. In this case, it's 3. So it puts 3 as the first element of this new array, which is of size this array plus this array. And then we're done with 3. We know that that one's been used. So we can move this one forward. This is the lowest element in this array. Now it's still here in this one because this one hasn't been put in the new array yet. So it says, okay, is 27 less than 43? And it is. And so it puts 27 here, and it moves what we're looking at back to 38. Compares these two. 38 is less than 43, puts 38 here. But then when it moves again, there's nothing left to do. So even if it had like a 48 and a 50, which you know it would because of up here, it knows that whatever you're going to tack on from this array, this is already sorted, and this is all higher than everything else you've done. So it just tacks the whole rest of it on here. It just happened to be that we only had 43. But it'll be a little different, I think, when we get to... Oh, it won't be that much different. And the same process happens here. And now we have these two, and these are all that's left. It's going to look at the first element of this array, element of this array. Which is lower? 3. What we're looking at now moves over 1 to the next lowest element in this array. Compares the two arrows again. Now it's 9. It's going to look again. Okay, now the lowest is 10. This guy moves again. Now which is lower? 27, lower than 82. And he just keeps making these comparisons. And then this guy is all done. This array is done. So whatever's left over here is just slapped on the end of it. So now, this process took n times to go through n. This process, if we were doing that, it would have taken 49 steps for an array of size 7. It looks like there are many fewer than, just count how many arrows there are down. So 2, 6, 12, 16. Let's say it takes about 20 steps. So it's a significant improvement. Like we're definitely making better, our time complexity is definitely better than n squared. And if you do the math out, you find out that in the average case, actually I think in almost all cases, merge sort runs on n log n time. I do not have time to go through the quicksort algorithm at length, but it also involves partitions and also like sorting each half of the array, but you can sort the array in place without actually sort of having these abstract subarrays. So that was kind of a crash course on time complexity, sorting algorithms, search algorithms. Now you know that you can always use binary search because you know how to sort an array, even if you want to use it this way, you want to do it this way, you want to go crazy and try it that way. So we study time complexity because we want to make the most efficient use of our resources in our computers. You know, for anybody who did the hackers in the problem set, your crack password thing, it might still be going. And you might have started running it on Thursday night. But efficient, if you had ran efficiently, the time complexity of this, you know, it'll still be some huge number, but it could be the difference between n to the c and c to the n, or c to the n and n factorial. So you always want to write programs that make the most efficient use of resources. Your computer only has so much memory, only has so much CPU power. You don't want to drain it unnecessarily. So keep time complexity in mind when you write your algorithms, and you will find that your programs run faster and cleaner and neater, and you'll have hopefully fewer bugs, fewer problems, and easier go of things. All right? That's it. Thank you.